This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, a panel of experts discuss the future of the Great Salt Lake, the negative effects caused by its rapid drying, and the efforts to conserve the lake and its waters. The political will to address the drying Great Salt Lake is high, with 80% of Utahns either very or somewhat concerned about the lake. State authorities have already begun major moves to address these concerns. Utah House Speaker Brad Wilson has announced Weber Basin and Jordan Valley Water will send an additional 30,000 acre-feet of water to the lake to help supplement the Great Salt Lake's low level. Speaker Wilson has also unveiled Utah Waterways, a coalition of state business leaders, to help develop programming and public awareness around the efforts to save the lake. The lake has also raised fears of worsening air pollution in Utah as exposed lake beds produce hazardous dust. Today's panel dives into the issues surrounding the Great Salt Lake and the work being done to preserve the iconic Utah landmark for future generations. The panel includes Craig Batars, Commissioner of the Utah Department of Agriculture and Food, Dr. Kevin Perry, Chair of the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Utah, and Kim Shelley, Executive Director of the Utah Department of Environmental Quality. The panel is moderated by Dr. Bonnie Baxter, Director of the Great Salt Lake Institute and Professor of Biology at Westminster College. This forum was co-sponsored by the University of Utah Office of Sustainability and the Wilkes Center for Climate Science and Policy. This forum was recorded on September 21st, 2022. Here is your moderator, Dr. Bonnie Baxter.
I'm grateful to bring this panel here and to have these experts and government officials up here to talk to. And so without further ado, I'll start with some introductions that are a little different than just the bios. I would like each of us to talk about both our professional and our personal connection to the lake. And I'll start by saying I connected to the lake as an outsider because I grew up sailing and playing around the islands in North Carolina. And when I moved here and took this job 25 years ago at Westminster, I decided to take my science into this extreme ecosystem. And so to me, it's always been this incredible place that I study and think about. And that leads to my professional connection, which is studying this changing lake system over the last 25 years. And so I have this lens by which I've watched things change as we monitor the changes. And about 5 years ago, I started speaking out about what was going on with increasing salinity. And then in 2020, I co-wrote the obituary for the lake, which it was supposed to be a lens from the future, though may seem a little premature. So that's my connection, both personally and professionally. Maybe Kim, we could start with you.
Sure. Well, despite being born and raised in Salt Lake, my appreciation for the lake didn't really start until I began working at the Department of Environmental Quality about 20 years ago. So I'm a latecomer as well. But through that lens, we permit all of the direct discharges into the lake. About 10% of the water flowing into the lake is coming from municipal wastewater treatment plants. And so that's one of the most significant sources that we regulate. And through that, I gained an appreciation for the lake, for its unique ecological systems there, as well as the economic importance. Over $1 billion in our economy is driven by this lake. And so it's incredibly important on that front, as well as the significant ecological importance for the hemisphere as a flyover stopping point. So really, it's something that I've connected to mostly in my professional career, but glad to be here and part of this discussion.
So. Thank you. Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah, sure. So like Kim, I'm also an outsider. I moved to Utah 21 years ago, just before the Winter Olympics. But before that, I've always been studying air quality issues. And one of the issues that I'd been studying was air quality in the national parks. And one of the issues that was impacting parks in the eastern part of the United States was transport of Saharan dust. So I have a long history of studying dust transport and the impacts of dust. And when I moved to Utah, like most Utahns, I didn't really appreciate what the Great Salt Lake was. Now, it's dirty, it's stinky, it's smelly. Why would anybody want to go there? And so the first 10 years I was in Utah, I think I visited it twice, sort of thing. But as the lake was shrinking, we started seeing dust plumes coming off the lake, and I immediately recognized the potential hazard associated with that. Eventually secured funding from the state to try and understand it better. And as I started going out to the lake for field work, I fell in love with the place. It's an absolutely incredible gem that is in serious danger of being unrecognizable in the near future. And so I kind of transformed from, you know, scientist to advocate for the lake as well, sort of thing. Dual role.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. Craig.
Thank you. My background's probably a little bit different than our other panelists. I was born and raised on a dairy farm in Cache County. And so my first tie to the lake was probably through its tributaries. Mm-hmm. And we irrigated with water from the Bear River on our farm. My earliest memories are of making our earth canals cement lined so that we were saving more water. And that translated into more sprinkler irrigation, more advanced types of sprinkler irrigation. So when I think about it, my tie to the Great Salt Lake and water conservation goes back to probably when I left high school, my early occupation. Now with my responsibilities, we work with water optimization, helping farmers throughout the state make sure that they are optimizing every drop of water that they are using and that they're still able to produce the same amount of crop with the same amount or less water than they have previously. So it's a great education opportunity. We have many farmers throughout the state who are anxious to make updates to their systems, and they only need a little bit of help, and we're there to help them.
I like that we took it from the lake to the playa to the whole watershed. Thank you for that. I also I think you get at something, Craig, about maybe your role in the crisis of the declining lake elevation. So would you say your role is in this helping farmers optimize their water usage?
I think it is. And a concern that I have is that a lot of people look at farming and ranching as the enemy when it comes to water for the Great Salt Lake. But there are a lot of benefits to agricultural water use through underground aquifer recharge, mm-hmm. through also stream water from runoffs from fields going into our streams and providing base flows for our streams. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me that as we pave over our agricultural land and build homes on our agricultural land, what's that doing to our temperature?
Right.
This year, we've seen a record number of days over 100 degrees. And it would be interesting to me to study the increase in temperature that is related to paving over our agricultural lands. You go out and stand in a cornfield or an alfalfa field, a hay field, or even in an irrigated pasture, your temperature there is going to be much cooler than on the top of a roof of a house or in a parking lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think humans have had lots of different impacts, and climate is showing itself in lots of different ways, but we're certainly seeing the increasing temperatures here in Utah, even in the mountains. So maybe I could take this to you, Kevin, in terms of our role in this oncoming crisis, or the crisis we're currently seeing before our eyes. I think as a scientist, like, part of my role is to stop just working in my lab, but to let the public know what I'm seeing. And so I've been interfacing more with the media and trying to communicate science in ways that are understandable to people who don't have a PhD. And I would love to hear what you think the role of a scientist is.
So up until about 3 years ago, I was very much siloed as a scientist where, you know, focus in on the publications, let them speak for themselves sort of thing. And I'd always been wary and concerned about potentially straying from that for fear of what your colleagues would think. But looking at the Great Salt Lake situation and the potential impacts that it has on millions of people, I decided to use my communication skills, hopefully I have some, to try and educate the public, because I was aware of something very early on in terms of the dust that other people just didn't understand the linkages between the lake and the potential health impacts. And so I've spent a lot of time doing a lot of interviews, basically trying to educate the public on all of the multifaceted issues surrounding the Great Salt Lake, because there's economic issues, there's development issues, there's water quality quantity, air quality issues. It affects the snowpack, it affects skiing. There's almost no part of northern Utah that's not impacted by the Great Salt Lake. And just spending my efforts trying to get the word out so that people can start to ask questions and hopefully be able to learn more about the problem so they can learn of what they can do to actually change the situation moving forward.
Yeah, excellent. Mm-hmm. So Kim, I was involved years ago, early in my career, with DEQ and the selenium conversations around Great Salt Lake, because many of you may not know that Great Salt Lake does not fall under the regulations of the Clean Water Act because it's not water that has fish in it. And so saline lakes are kind of a unique situation. And we spent a lot of money in this state to come up with one selenium standard, right? So I remember that, and I know that your office has also been involved with the landfill operation on Promontory. And so you've seen the lake come up in your conversations, but this is a different situation. Is DEQ's role now about air pollution with respect to the lake? Like, what do you think your role in the crisis is?
That's an excellent question, and I think our role is still being defined, but just to give a little background on my department, because we are a department that kind of works in the background to protect public health and the environment. We have five divisions. We implement federal pollution control laws as well as state develop laws, and as Bonnie mentioned, we also develop standards for all of our water bodies here in the state. Great Salt Lake, because it is so unique with the salinity concerns, it's a terminal lake, as everyone knows. We have not yet been able to develop standards that are fully protective of this lake. We do have a narrative standard that helps us as we issue these permits for folks to discharge to the lake, but also, as you mentioned, we have a selenium standard that is a tissue-based standard, not a water column-based standard. So the lake is complex with everything that DEQ does, but really all of our divisions have a role in protecting that lake. Most prominently, it's the Division of Air Quality, as well as the Division of Water Quality, as they work to implement stormwater controls as well as point source discharge controls. So our role has stayed the same, but we're seeing it, as Kevin mentioned, with more advocacy, more awareness, it's becoming elevated in the public's eye, which we're appreciative of, because there are more resources that are needed to go towards this lake. And if the public is aware and engaged, we think we'll get there as a state.
So. Yeah, awesome. I think we need to give the audience a little bit of background about Great Salt Lake and how we got here at this place. Some of you, raise your hand if you've been to Great Salt Lake. Oh, my heart is happy.
That's good.
Way more people than I anticipated. Fantastic. Anybody else want to go, let me know. I'll just start by saying there was a publication from some USU scientists back in 2017 in Nature Geoscience that pointed to saline lakes all around the world. In particular, these scientists work on Great Salt Lake, and they measure inflows in water quantity and capacity coming into the lake. And they point to water diversions over the last century shrinking this lake 40% of its size. So I think that the story, as I see it, is water diversions for our population upstream of the watershed that Craig was alluding to have gotten us into this situation, and it's population, it's for housing, it's for development, consumptive uses for agriculture, And now we're not getting enough water trickling down to the bottom of this terminal lake. So terminal lakes have inflow from precipitation and from the rivers coming in, but only water evaporates, so it leaves all the salts behind. So if you have too much evaporation and not enough precipitation and water coming in, you end up shrinking and getting saltier and saltier. So I think now we're meeting the challenges of the mega drought in the Southwest and climate change. And we're not prepared to meet those challenges because we have diverted water in the system. So how do you back that up? And that belongs to these folks who are in policy and you folks who are interested in policy, because that's where the solutions lie, I think. So that's my world overview of how we got here. Kevin, what do you want to add to that?
I just want to add one thing. And it's very easy to say that the lake issues are being caused by climate change, or they're being caused by the mega drought. And that's not how we got into this situation. That study from Utah State was very well done, and basically identified the fact that the lake has shrunk 11 feet due to water diversion, and the ongoing mega drought that we have right now has shrunk it an additional 6 feet beyond that. So it's a cumulative impact from both of those sorts of things. But if we had been putting in enough water to sustain the lake, then the lake would be 11 feet higher than it is right now. And to put that into perspective, if we have an average snowpack, 100% normal snowpack, the skiers are happy, it's average, but the amount of water that makes it to the Great Salt Lake is insufficient, and the lake will continue to shrink. In order for the lake to be balanced right now because of the water diversions, we have to have 130% of snowpack just for the lake to break even. And clearly that's not sustainable for the long run. And although I really appreciated your obituary because it helped draw attention to the potential future of the lake, I like to be optimistic because we got into this situation by choices that we made on how we value water. And we can get ourselves out of this situation by altering that valuation and changing how we our relationship with water. Mother Nature would be helpful in this scenario.
Yeah.
But mega droughts don't last forever. The rains will return. But the question is, will the ecosystem still be alive when those rains return?
Yeah, I like that. I don't like that, but I like your explanation of that. Craig, I'm curious, you spent some time in Utah's House of Representatives. And I know you must have been watching the last legislative session and how robust the passing of laws that had to do with water was, bipartisan and unanimous. Could you give us a background on where we are with water policy? And I think you actually, in your time, actually spent some time in water policy yourself. So can you give us some ideas of where we are in the background of water policy?
Well, I think one of the biggest things that the last legislative session did was pass over $200 million to go to secondary metering.
Yep.
And we find that if we meter our secondary water sources, most people don't have any idea how much water they are actually consuming or putting on their lawns or other properties, their gardens.
To those of us who grew up with a lot of water and there wasn't such thing as secondary water, can you explain what that is?
So secondary water is the water that is the water that's outside that does not come into your home. Secondary water is a different system than the culinary system, and it's water that hasn't been treated, and so it's not drinkable. But it is used to irrigate our golf courses, our public parks and things like that. And so that's what secondary water is considered.
In
and
rural
irrigation
communities,
water also.
Yeah, so in rural communities, it's coming into canals sometimes for them to use for irrigation.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's correct. And so that was one of the big pluses of the last legislative session. There's also a $40 million appropriation to the Great Salt Lake that going directly to study ways that we can solve this problem. And we, as a Department of Agriculture and Food, for our water optimization program, got $70 million, which was a huge appropriation. And we've had two rounds of funding for that water optimization program. The first round, we had over 140 applications that we approved. And those projects will total about $25 million. That is matched with another $25 million from the agricultural producers, or you know, from other sources. So, and the latest round of funding, which closed September 1st, over 200 applications for this water funding. And those applications totaled $35 million. We're currently evaluating which ones of those applications will actually meet the qualifications. And then next spring, it's possible that we will have another round of applications for water optimization projects. Do you want me to go into details about what those projects are?
Just briefly, okay. And briefly. Then we'll turn it over briefly. To Kim. Yeah.
It could be for lining canals and ditches, mm-hmm. so that we don't lose as much water through seepage. It can be through changing flood irrigation to sprinkler irrigation, or even more efficient land leveling and then flooding irrigation. We're looking for increase of water efficiency from 30% efficiency and up to as much as 90% efficiency on our irrigation water.
Awesome. So. Thank you for such a great explanation. Kim, how are these new water policies impacting DEQ? Are you getting involved yet, or are you getting involved more in the air quality dust issues?
Definitely, we're involved across the water and the air quality issues. Just to touch on an important thing that was passed this last session that allows for individuals or corporations that own a water right to be able to lease that water right out and not have any fear of losing the water because they're not using it. And so this can go that it provides base flow in our streams, can ultimately provide additional water to the Great Salt Lake. So this is a game changer and a significant update to our water policy, which I'm grateful for. You know, we can't protect water quality when we have no water in our streams and don't have any, you know, an ecosystem to protect. So making this significant shift will be a game changer for DEQ as well as the state as a whole. Just one other thing, you know, with the ARPA dollars, the federal dollars that were awarded to the state, that has really supercharged a lot of our projects and helping our communities be more resilient on the drinking water and wastewater space as we experience some of the challenges that have come along with drought. So I'm grateful for the money that's been appropriated to DEQ. We also have some infrastructure dollars coming into the state, about $300 million that will also be funneled back into these programs, primarily in the Wasatch Front and then the southern part of the state.
That was Kim Shelley, Executive Director of the Utah Department of Environmental Quality. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. On this program, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. Today, a panel of experts discuss the drying of the Great Salt Lake and the efforts to preserve the Utah landmark. Here again is your moderator, Dr. Bonnie Baxter.
I want to bring forth the role of journalists that have been covering these stories. Great Salt Lake has gotten a lot of media attention in the last year since we hit a historic low last summer. And I'm grateful for that. I think journalists have been doing an amazing job. It's really hard to be interviewed and talk to journalists all the time, which I'm sure you guys know. But I want to give a shout out to the Great Salt Lake Collaborative, which in Utah is a group of the major media outlets, including KUER, that are funded by the Solutions Journalism Network, which builds collaboration among journalists instead of competition, and they are working on Great Salt Lake as an issue. So if you pay attention to media, you're going to hear that they're sharing each other's stories, and GSL Collaborative is the website for that. So I think it's interesting to look at policy and the science and the journalism and to try to draw arrows mm-hmm. between those things. Do you have any reflection on that? What is the role of journalism and bringing forth the policy and the science, or what's the role of the policy in connecting back to journalism?
That's an excellent question. I'll start and hope that my additional panels will fill in the gaps for me, but I think journalism, as well as the advocacy groups, provide an invaluable service in elevating issues to policymakers. There are so many issues that our policymakers are faced with every day, and elevating these issues and bringing them to the forefront is so important in making progress. So I think they play a vital role, and I'm grateful for the attention that's been focused on this issue.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so I can give a concrete example. When I moved here 21 years ago, if you did a poll of what people cared about, education was number one, and then there was a host of different things that would rise up. There was a concerted effort made by a few individuals and some nonprofits to try and educate the public about the linkages between air quality and human health. I didn't always approve of their methodology. They tried to scare people in some cases, but over time, the education level for people in Utah is now extremely high when it comes to air quality issues. And I'm always surprised when I talk to a group of people, how many of you think the air quality in Utah is getting worse? How many of you think it's getting better? It's actually getting a lot better.
Thank you, Kevin.
So what's going on? Well, the Division of Air Quality and the EPA have worked really hard to improve air quality. And if you compare it to what it was 20 or 30 years ago, it's much, much better. But people are much more aware and cognizant of the dangers associated with poor air quality. And that was an educational outreach campaign. And it required coordination between advocates, scientists, and journalists. And I'm hoping that we can have a similar educational campaign to get the word out on all of the multifaceted issues associated with the lake, because there's not, like air quality, there's not one single thing you can do to solve the problem. You have to have all the stakeholders at the table. Everybody has to be part of the solution.
Wow, okay, that well said. Mm-hmm. I wanna move on to impacts. What, if we fail to act, if we fail to save this lake, what, could you give me the number one impact that you're the most concerned about, Craig?
Wow. I thought you were going to go somewhere else with that question.
And you could give me your top three. You don't have to narrow it to one.
Well, I think the dust issue and the toxic compounds that we see in the dust is going to impact not only our greatest populations along the Wasatch Front, but even, you know, in other areas of the state. And so, we have businesses that are actually dependent upon the Great Salt Lake, you know, with the brine shrimp industry, our magnesium industry, and some of those other things. And of course, they will be gone. But I think the health and safety of our citizens is my biggest concern. And that's, I think, what we all, I think that's the word that gets out to the population. And overall, I think that our citizens really understand the importance of saving the Great Salt Lake.
Yeah. I suddenly, in the last 6 months, probably receive emails from citizens at a level that tell me I should be a public official. And the questions are often about air quality and what should I do? Should I sell my house? Those kinds of things. And it's hard to hear that, you know, mm-hmm. People really do care. Mm-hmm. Kim, I want to bounce over to you. What do you think is your top priority? Your top concern beyond what Craig talked about, if we fail to act, if we fail to save the lake?
This is difficult. I mean, of course, public health is something that my agency is charged with protecting, and that's our number one issue. But also, you know, if that ecosystem fails, what does it mean for the ripple effects that it will have across the U.S. and the world? I am very concerned about that. And I think, you know, we may not feel those immediately in Utah, but I think, you know, the impacts could be real and, you know, life-altering over time, and that is a significant concern.
And you're taking this out of our state even.
Absolutely.
And I think Kevin would probably agree with that, that this isn't, dust isn't controlled, nor is water, by state boundaries.
Mm-hmm. So I kind of look at the lake as tipping points. So when the lake hits certain thresholds, you have certain consequences associated with that. We have already hit the tipping point for dust. We now have issues, and it will continue to get worse over time the longer the lake bed is exposed. We have already hit the tipping point for recreation. They've had to pull all the boats from the lake because they simply can't maintain access for the marinas. And we're getting close to the tipping point for industry. And as moderator, you haven't talked a lot about, you've been asking the questions, but I would throw one back to you. Yeah. There's another tipping point, which is the salinity tipping point.
Yeah, I'd love to take that one, Ken.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we I'm on the state salinity advisory committee, and we've been working on, for the last couple of years, on what is the salinity at which the ecosystem crashes. And we decided if the water was holding, if 17% of the water was salt, that 17% is too salty for the ecosystem. And at 16%, we needed to sound the alarms. And so about the time we came out with our report, we hit 16%. So now we're above 18%. Last week, measurements by the state were 18.4% out on the open water. And that's terrifying to me. I study the cyanobacteria that the brine flies eat, and brine flies feed many sectors of birds because some dive to eat their little cocoons off the bottom of the lake. Some birds eat the little caterpillars out of the water, and others eat the adults either on the top of the water or on the shore. So it's many different types of birds. 10 million birds come to this body of water to feed up before they migrate on. That is an enormous avian stronghold. And I think it's probably the most important body of water for birds on the Pacific Flyway. So that being said, what we're seeing before our eyes are billions of brine flies dead on the shores, and the cyanobacterial mats that feed them gone off any of these mounds that are in the lake. Most of the mounds are now, or many of the mounds are now exposed on the beach. So what we're seeing from the ecosystem standpoint is not good. It's really terrible. So this life has evolved to live at something that's much higher in salt concentration than the ocean, which is only like 3.4%. But there still is a salinity threshold. There is a place that's too salty. So we are seeing devastating consequences right now on the lake's biology. So thank you for asking me that. But I'm very concerned because the more the lake shrinks, the saltier it gets. Yep. Yeah. So let's turn to solutions. Let's wake this up a little bit. Yeah? So what do you think, if you could talk about maybe individual actions or collective actions by the people in this room, how can we make a difference as individuals in this devastating crisis of water, essentially, which becomes a crisis of dust and other things, a crisis of economy and a crisis of many things. Craig, I'll start with you.
Okay. You know, I think we all need to turn inward and look at our water usage and our expectations and do what we can to minimize our water usage. And you know, personally, I feel like, okay, there are things that I can do in my yard at home. You know, change my garden to drip irrigation systems. There are a lot of things, and our research institutions here in the state have done a fantastic job about providing information as to how we can decrease our personal usage and also our environmental usage on our homes and our parks and different things like that.
Good. Kevin, what do you think?
So we live in the second driest state in the nation, Utah. And the amount of water that we use per person is off the charts compared to our Western peers. We also happen to have the cheapest water. And I try and understand how those two things can go together. And it has to do with how we value water. And so from my perspective, the first step in this process is educating the public and you know, spreading the word about the crisis that we have. But also the simple fact of the matter is that I hate looking at Las Vegas and saying they're doing much better with their water than we are. I hate looking at Phoenix and saying, wow, I would love to get to the point where we're using the same amount of water as people in Phoenix. And so, but it's not just that. I mean, it's you know, we have to look at it in terms of cities. We have to look at it in terms of agriculture. We have to look at it in terms of industry. And you know, the legislative changes that were made were, you know, very significant last year, but they were just a start. We need to continue that momentum so that we can end up touching all of these different things. And I just wanted to say that some people demonize agriculture, and that's the furthest from the truth. If you actually do a poll of the people of Utah, they very much want to have a robust agricultural sector. They want to be self-sufficient. And so the answer is not to pick on agriculture, it's to partner with agriculture, to partner with cities, and to partner with industry to try and find creative solutions for reducing our water footprints.
And so if I wanted to get involved in that, is the tagline, write your legislator, like, is that a useful way to get your voice heard about water policy, water pricing structure, all of those things? How do we make a difference with
that? The legislature is always already acutely aware.
Yeah.
They have heard from the public. The governor, the speaker of the House, and the president of the Senate have all publicly stated that saving the Great Salt Lake is a very high priority. The Speaker of the House led a Great Salt Lake Forum, the first, in January to try and educate legislators on the issue.
And there'll be a second one in October.
There'll be a second one in October to try and come up and solicit ideas for what needs to be done in the next round in the legislative session. There's also been tours of the Great Salt Lake for the legislators so they can see firsthand the issues that are out there. But still, when I talk to the public, more often than not, when I talk to somebody, they're unaware of the issues.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that the more people are aware of it, the more that they can do about it. And I'm also surprised by how many people have never visited the Great Salt Lake.
Yeah.
And they don't know what they're about to lose.
Bear witness.
So I definitely encourage everybody to go out and explore as well, because once you see it, you recognize its importance and its significance and the beauty of the place.
Okay, so I'm hearing cut back on your personal water uses. I'm hearing to write your legislators, and I'm hearing to tell friends, right? Yes, and what else?
I'd just like to bring up your local. Local governments, your municipalities, your counties, they have a lot of things that they can do also through their municipal systems and through their wastewater treatment and different things like this to help use water more efficiently and hopefully get more of that into the lake.
Excellent. Okay, Kim, what about you?
Well, solutions are, first of all, just want to say that it isn't a foregone conclusion that it's going to be doom and gloom. I think there's still time for us to act. So I don't want anyone to be discouraged that we've already reached, DEFCON 5 or whatever it is. I definitely, the alarm bells have been sounded. They've been going on for a number of years, and that we also have the best and the brightest in the state at our universities and the policy space and in the executive branch as well working on this. But I would like to just kind of echo some of the things. Educating yourselves, talking to your neighbors about their water use. I believe that the people in Utah want to do the right thing. They want a healthy and vibrant environment, but if we know better, we always do better. So definitely talking to your friends, municipalities, and your local elected officials also have a stake in this as well. And if you can advocate or reach out to them and let them know how important this is, I think it will also help elevate the issue at their level. And finally, to Bonnie's point, the legislature is acutely aware of this, but it doesn't hurt for folks to also advocate for specific issues. If you would like building codes changed to include more water-efficient fixtures, et cetera, please reach out. I think there's an opportunity for individuals to advocate for things that can really make a difference to the lake.
Yes.
And then, the Great Salt Lake Advisory Council essentially put together a 12-step program for saving the Great Salt Lake.
12 strategies, yeah.
And I think that the legislators basically took on, I think, three of those last session sort of thing. And so there's still a roadmap for things that can be done. The legislature passed HCR 10, which was another study to try and come up with strategies for saving the Great Salt Lake. And I believe that there were 60 or 70 recommendations as part of that as well. And we've only ticked off a few of those as well, sort of thing. So there are some roadmaps that are out there. The president of the University of Utah has kind of authorized a Great Salt Lake Strike Team that is currently trying to provide data and answers to specific questions from the state legislature regarding water use and water modeling. And so we're doing what we can here at the University of Utah as well.
That's nice. That's mm-hmm. nice. And I appreciate like the things you can do in your home or your garden. I mean, those are low-hanging fruit, right? The benefit to the drop of water used for agriculture is different than the benefit for using to grow a lawn in your yard, right? So I think target low-hanging fruit is one of the lessons that I've been learning from folks who talk to me about how they're saving water. Last week, I heard from a friend that he is collecting a bucket of water when he waits for the shower to heat up, and then he uses that to flush the toilet. And I had an elderly gentleman tell me that he's not flushing the toilet every time. And so I think we can all do our part. Be creative, okay?
That was Dr. Bonnie Baxter, director of the Great Salt Lake Institute and professor of biology at Westminster College. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. In this final segment, the panel answers questions from the live audience.
How has St. George and other southern Utah's cities' reaction to our water issue up here, what has their response been, and have they been receptive of the fact that they're some of our largest water users as well?
I'd like to take that one. So I'm pleased to report that Washington County now has the most restrictive water use in the state. So they are leading out on this. They have recognized their water situation and are being very innovative. They were one of the first communities in the state to reuse their effluent, so their treated wastewater. It irrigates all of their golf courses and their city parks, and they are on all new construction will have these new restrictions. So they are being responsive. The Lake Powell pipeline is still something that's on the shelf, but I think that their goal is to conserve first and then reach out for, you know, additional resources may be needed in the future, but they have led out on conservation so far. So I'm really impressed with their response.
And I'd just like to add one thing. Unfortunately, the growth rate in St. George is astronomical right now.
Right.
And so despite the fact of the conservation efforts that are going in place, there's still significant pressures on the water that have to do with population growth. And if you think about, you know, what the limiting factor for growth in our state is, it's actually water, water availability. And that needs to be increasingly recognized as a limitation moving forward.
I could add, you know, our agricultural producers statewide right now are suffering because of the drought. And a lot of our reservoirs are basically empty. And so this drought hits agricultural producers first, and every year they face the possibility of having their water rights decreased. As we rolled out the water optimization program, and we actually worked through the applications so that a project that benefited the Great Salt Lake through our watersheds here received a higher ranking than other projects throughout the state. And, you know, we had a little bit of pushback from some of our farmers and ranchers in other areas of the state, but I think they came to realize that this is our critical focus. It's where our focus needs to be right now is on the Great Salt Lake. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll just point that St. George is a different watershed than the Northern Utah watershed, which I think you know, but in case people don't know where St. George is. So I love to hear that they're modeling good water usage. Yeah. Next question.
Hello, one comment and one question. I've moved to Salt Lake about 30 years ago, and at that time I heard that we were the number one driest state in the country and also use the most water. And here we are 30 years and we're still hearing it, and I have not seen anything really done. My question is, what are the immediate danger of these dust storms to the population that, you know, we're addressing it, but the storms are coming and this toxic stuff is coming. So what is the state and we're doing to try to help our children, seniors, everybody from the causes of this toxic stuff that's coming.
Okay. Thank you. And yeah, that definitely something that my agency through the Division of Air Quality is acutely aware of. It's a difficult issue. You know, that there are constituents of dust that have been labeled as toxic. Those concerns typically with dust, there isn't, with those toxic elements such as arsenic, there isn't an acute exposure risk. It's more of a long-term exposure where some of the health effects are felt. However, dust in and of itself causes significant respiratory impacts. And so it is a real concern across the state. You know, as I understand it, that some of the dust along the Wasatch Front not only comes from the Great Salt Lake, but also the Sevier Lake, which is another drying lake bed. And so we have many, multiple dust sources here in the state. The Division of Air Quality has a fugitive dust program where if we have a responsible party or someone that is causing the dust, we can work with them to control it. But for right now, I think that the goal is to get water to the Great Salt Lake to minimize the drying lake bed that can then be kicked up during an elevated windstorm. But your point is well taken, that there are actions that will be happening during the next legislative session, and I think that we will get there much faster than we did this last round of progress for 30 years. But Kevin, maybe you have something to add to that.
Yeah, so I've had concerned citizens calling me up with all sorts of ideas and what we can do about the dust. And I think I kind of point them to lessons learned from Owens Dry Lake in California. Owens Dry Lake is a lake that was purposely dried up by Los Angeles in the early 1900s, and it turned out to be the largest dust source in North America. It also contains arsenic. But it's much smaller than the Great Salt Lake. It's only 1/12 the size of the Great Salt Lake. And it was routinely violating the ambient air quality standards. We're not seeing that yet from the Great Salt Lake. So they were violating the air quality standards, so the federal government mandates that they spend money to try and mitigate that. They put up snow fences to try and slow the wind down. Mm-hmm. They tried building berms and doing drip irrigation to put vegetation there to hold the soil in place. They tried plowing it at one point to increase the surface roughness to slow the wind down. And they got desperate, and they tried to put gravel over large mm-hmm. portions of that lake bed. And still, it's the largest dust source in North America. And what they learned from their $2 billion investment is that the best solution for dust mitigation is water on the surface. And I think that that's ultimately the lesson that we can learn, is that the saving the Great Salt Lake and solving the dust problem are inextricably linked.
So my question just has to deal with more like, I know like we can like save our own water, but like, is there any like restrictions or like policies that are going to go against businesses? Because just walking around downtown, I see so many businesses having green grass, and it just seems like unequal and unfair. So like, is there anything like that's going to happen with like businesses?
So that is something that is controlled at the local level. So the state has some influence, but unfortunately it has to happen at the local level, and that's where advocacy will come in, with you all reaching out to your local elected officials to say, hey, it matters to me that we don't have grass at every single parking strip, or that we're irrigating something that I only walk on to mow it, right? If it isn't useful, then we should convert it to something that consumes less water. So I would encourage you all to reach out to your local elected officials to have them change their ordinances that will allow for those types of policies to be adopted.
Also, I'll mention that some of my students have talked about even campus usage of water, and I would say that even starting locally, as local as your institution, is also a place to ask questions about water usage. And does this area really need to be grass, or could it be a different kind of grass, and those kinds of things? I know there's some people doing some very progressive things on this campus, but start to pay attention to that and ask questions.
We have a question from online, and it's, are there water collection methods that we can employ to increase precipitation, like cloud seeding?
I can comment on cloud seeding. As a county executive in Cache County, we had a contract every year with a company that did cloud seeding. And so, you know, I know that there are a lot of projects along the Wasatch Front that are doing the cloud seeding, and we do see increase in precipitation through the studies that we've done on that.
Yeah, if I can just add, I believe for the Great Salt Lake, cloud seeding or weather modification could add about 5%, if my memory is serving me, to the total water, to the total snowfall that occurs in our mountains. So it's a significant amount, and I think there's opportunities for us to explore that.
Kevin, do you know any of the science with cloud seeding?
It contradicts what other people are thinking and saying sort of thing.
Yeah, that's what I've heard as well.
So when it comes to cloud seeding, there's been a long history of studies trying to demonstrate a measurable increase in precipitation. And essentially, it boils down to the fact that you can't have a laboratory-controlled experiment. And if you seed one cloud and you have another cloud that's next to it, do they still have the same situations? Is one likely to rain versus the other? And the simple fact of the matter is that the science has not shown a demonstrated ability to increase precipitation associated with that. On the laboratory scale, yes, you can convert liquid droplets to ice, and ice crystals grow much faster and will then precipitate out. But it involves getting the ice nucleating agents to the proper part of the cloud in the right type of cloud, which is extremely difficult to do from ground-based things. Now, that being said, I know Idaho spends millions of dollars a year in cloud seeding. Mm-hmm. And their philosophy is, well, we don't know if the science is there to back it up, but the possibility of giving even 5% moisture, right, is such that it's worth it, even if we can't conclusively prove that it's effective. Scientifically, it's a very difficult thing to prove, but people are desperate. Right. And different people will try anything to try and increase the amount of precipitation. And I'll say the conclusive part will be, if you can show that you're able to to increase the amount of precipitation, the states downwind will sue you because you're stealing their water.
Stealing their water. I will ask a science question, maybe to the science gods, but there is above a saline lake a chloride ion cloud, essentially. And I can imagine that if this has been done in the laboratory, it's not been modeled with saline environments. And I don't know how that might impact. It impacts atmospheric deposition mercury, for example, and allows it to be mercury chloride, which is soluble. So would it interfere with cloud seeding? And I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah. I don't know the answer either.
Yeah.
Hi. I have just one question. It seems to me that it's clear that the most straightforward solution is to reduce our water use and be more efficient. I'm wondering to hear your opinion on the idea that, I know that water use in Utah is so high because the cost is low, and that's low because property taxes are used to subsidize water costs. I'm wondering to hear your opinion if we eliminate that subsidy to raise the cost on those who use water the most, lower taxes, wouldn't it result in a more efficient use of our water?
I think none of us are sociologists or psychologists, which is where some of that lies. But what I will tell you is the studies on cities around the West where they increase the cost of water, 100% of the time the use of water goes down. So I think that that is an excellent strategy. And the fact that we in Utah hide the cost of water in property taxes means that it's not transparent. What you're paying looks really cheap, right? So I think being more transparent and having a tiered pricing structure, from my point of view as a person naive about water policy, I just don't know why we haven't tried that yet. Like, it seems simple, right? Next. Who wants to take that on? Anyone want to argue with
that? Well, I would just say that with the secondary metering that the legislature passed, that's what our intent is, to help people understand the true cost of the water that they're using.
We're wrapping things up there. If you'd like to hear the full forum, you can find it on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible, in part, by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.